Welcome to Philadelphia United Lodge of Theosophists. We will open the meeting with a reading of the Declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles. Through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Our program here in Philadelphia for carrying out this declaration is two weekly meetings. This Sunday morning one, obviously, and in the month of March, our theme for Sunday is Humanity is Never Without a Friend. Today, we're hearing the work of the Lodge of Adepts, and next Sunday, the 13th, the Invisible Guardian Wall. The doors open at 10:30 on Sunday morning. The meeting is from 11 to 12. There's always plenty of time to peruse things at the book table and plenty of time for questions and discussion after the presentation. The Wednesday nights, we have a reference library that is open from 5:15 to 7:15 and a class, a study class, that meets from 7:30 to 8:30. We are studying the ocean of theosophy, going through it stroke by stroke, chapter by chapter. It's a big ocean. The book table is open before and after meetings or during the library hours, and the work that is done here is all on the basis of voluntary service. There's no salaried people. There's nothing but donations, and we don't even pass the hat. So if you feel prompted to donate, you may do so at the book table or at the little container on one of the bookcases if you want to remain anonymous. But of course, if your donations are tax deductible, so why remain anonymous? The book table carries a straight line of theosophical literature that is available to you at cost, the cost of shipping and printing. It's not for-profit sales, as you will discover. I think The Secret Doctrine, two volumes, sells for $25 or something. So, as you will see, they're very inexpensive and worth owning. However, we should also remind you that you can stop at the book table, get the website for the Phoenix ULT, which has scanned all of the major theosophical books. So you can go online, read them, search them by a word. It's a wonderful service. The introduction to the talk this morning is taken from the Voice of the Silence. No, conqueror of sins, once that a Sewanee hath crossed the seventh path, all nature thrills with joyous awe and feels subdued. The silver star now twinkles out the news to the night blossoms. The streamlet to the pebbles ripples out the tale. Dark ocean waves will roar it to the rocks surf-bound. Scent-laden breezes sing it to the vales, and stately pines mysteriously whisper, a master has arisen, a master of the day. He standeth now like a white pillar to the west, upon whose face the rising sun of thought, eternal, poureth forth its first, most glorious waves. His mind, like a becalmed and boundless ocean, spreadeth out in shortest space. He holdeth life and death in his strong hand. Yea, he is mighty, the living power made free in him, that power which is himself, can raise the tabernacle of illusion high above the gods, above great Brahm and Indra. Now he shall surely reach his great reward. Shall he not use the gifts which it confers for his own rest and bliss, his well-earned weal and glory, he, the subduer of the great delusion? Nay, O thou candidate for nature's hidden lore, if one would follow in the steps of holy Tathagata, those gifts and powers are not for self. Wouldst thou thus dam the waters born on Sumeru? Shall thou divert the stream for thine own sake, or send it back to its prime source among the crests of cycles? If thou wouldst have that stream of hard-earned knowledge, of wisdom, heaven-born, remain sweet running waters, thou shouldst not leave it to become a stagnant pond. No, if of Amitabha, the boundless age, thou wouldst become co-worker, then must thou shed the light acquired, like to the Bodhisattva's twain, upon the span of all three worlds. Know that the stream of superhuman knowledge and the Deva wisdom thou hast won must, from thyself, the channel of Alaya, be poured forth into another bed. Know, O Narjo, thou of the secret path, its pure fresh waters must be used to sweeter make the ocean's bitter waves, that mighty sea of sorrows formed of the tears of men. While they sit, let me get you some water.
Thanks. Our title for the month of March, the overall umbrella theme, Humanity Has Never Been Without a Friend, is actually taken from the words of William Q. Judge in the first chapter of the Ocean of the Silence, of the Ocean of Theosophy. And it epitomizes the work of the Lodge. And perhaps even before delving in to that ocean, we should consider the significance of those words. Humanity. By humanity, we are referring to the entire human race, regardless of its apparent superficial differences, and even its differences of race and creed and religious conviction. It includes all races, nations, and civilizations. So we are speaking of an all-inclusive idea of humanity. And that word, never, never. It means that for as long as humanity has been on the scene here on this planet, and for long as it will be in the far distant future, and even today, it has never been without a friend. And sometimes we lose sight of that word friend. We have thousands of friends on Facebook and all sorts of people we might call friends or a list of friends. But a friend is one who is always ready to assist us in our struggles and is committed to our happiness and interests even above their own. Think of that. A friend of humanity, interested in its welfare and interests when most of us don't even know what our welfare and interests and our real happiness is. So this friend does not then refer to a single human being, but an uninterrupted chain of beings, an enduring, all-embracing network of beneficial and powerful influence and guidance that has always been present and even felt by humanity. Well, if this friend or this network of friends has such knowledge, power, and compassion, where, how, when did they develop it? Especially when we can say that humanity has never been without a friend. Well, most people, as it's pointed out in the ocean of theosophy, believe that they have a soul. They may have a very vague idea of what that is. But theosophy teaches that humanity or human beings essentially are soul beings using a physical body. And by saying that humanity or human being is a soul being, it means that as souls we have powers, we have capacities, and we have responsibilities. And those powers and capacities and responsibilities can be misused, or they can be abused, or they can be used and developed to even higher degrees. So when the term is used, a perfected human being or a perfected soul, we are speaking of a human being, a soul being, who has developed all those soul capacities, mental, psychic, spiritual, to the highest possible degree in this period of evolution provided for us on this earth. So theosophy would teach, and does teach, that there is a fraternity, a lodge, if you will, of perfected souls, a lodge of adepts, elder brother souls of humanity. And every period of evolution sees an increase in the numbers of these souls. So what exactly does that term, the lodge of adepts, really mean? Well, consider that we are soul beings in every age, in every nation, in every race, throughout time. There have been individual souls, no matter how few, who have felt within their own heart the inspiration to improve, to expand, to devote themselves to the benefit of humanity. And the ones that are successful in this effort, who carry that vow, that conviction, life after life, and reach that high development, become adepts. So an adept becomes. It's not made from any outside source, not any special, unique being, but rather has developed all the germs of capacities of soul that lie latent in every human being. So they are perfected souls, but this is important. They are also living, embodied human beings, dwelling in every age in certain parts of the earth. So they have understand the human experience. They feel it. They are human beings of flesh and blood as we are, but perhaps bodies compensate with their high development. And as human beings able to communicate in various ways, they know each other and they communicate all over the world, despite the fact that they may be separated by continents and oceans. But here is a part of the point, and having heard our declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, the Lodge of Adepts is not a place, a physical locality. It is a collectivity of beings united by their similarity of aim, purpose, and understanding of truth. And yet, even all these things we've said are true, their knowledge, their wisdom, their understanding of who and what they are, what we are, what this universe is far greater than our ordinary understanding can comprehend. So naturally, there is some effort to try to lift us up to be able to see in degrees what they see. So the question is, well, if they live in various parts of the earth suitable to their environment and understanding and development, do they ever appear publicly among human beings? And it is said that they do appear publicly when the conditions are ripe according to various cycles. And we see cycles govern the affairs and conditions of human beings, individuals, nations, races. And we understand this in our own life. There we go through cycles of moods and physical condition and mental alertness when certain things said and put before us can have a much different impact and impression and response from us than when we were in a different mood or cycle. So understanding these great cycles, they appear among humanity at different times. And from the ranks of this Lodge of Adepts have come to mankind its savior teachers. There have been other kinds of agents of this lodge. Some have been philosophers, divine rulers, and great teachers in general. But the idea of the savior teacher is important for us to understand, because in our various religions, we hold these individuals up to be unique beings, somehow divinely favored, or maybe incarnations of God or deity itself. But Theosophy teaches that these have become saviors, have become teachers through their own effort, life after life, and have awakened and developed and have become able to express the same divine essence and capacity and power that is within every human being. And by saving us, it is not meant that they eliminate all our sins. It does not mean that they do things for us. But by the example of their lives and by their teachings and by their encouragement and inspiration, they try whenever the opportunity presents itself to awaken us to our nature, destiny, and power as soul beings. So the agents of this lodge have worked among humanity in every one of its smaller and greater cycles. And it would be an interesting study if we wanted to, even for those familiar with Western history, because we could go back and trace throughout Egypt, Greece, up through the Middle Ages, into the Renaissance, the effort of different groups and individuals to present these same ideas or a constant line of teaching and effort and influence. So we ask ourselves, okay, you're presenting an idea, but how can I prove it? What evidence is there that I can begin to try to check, test, and verify for myself that such a lodge of adepts exists and has always existed and is in fact a friend of humanity? Well, once again, the emphasis here on how can I prove it? So it's going to take some independent effort and study. Nobody else can prove it for you. You have to prove it for yourself, but another person can point out the way, the direction, where to look. And so the presence of great souls are historical facts. We have their lives and their works recorded for us throughout the nations and races of humanity, whether we're talking about Eastern lands or Western lands. In the East, they have been called avatars and rishis, mahatmas. As we move into Egypt and the Middle East, we hear reference to the magi, hierophants, initiates, divine kings, but wise men, kings of the East. But all this idea represents that there have been those among us who bear gifts of wisdom and knowledge and are there for our benefit. So that's one thing. We have historical records, and we also have traditions, common traditions in the records of individuals in Americas, in Europe, in Asia, in every continent. But we also have, as a body of evidence, their teachings, which are at once scientific, meaning they can be checked, tested, verified, applied. They're philosophical, meaning that they explain things to us. And they are religious in the sense they unite all beings and all of us into an understanding of our unity of source and our unity of purpose and how we must help one another if we are to advance. And so we have their teachings, and none of them appeared to write anything down themselves, although they had students that did, but they left them behind them like footprints in the sand or traces on a wall. Definite evidence of their teaching. We see it in the myths, the common myths of the teachers. And one of those myths we'll go into in a moment. But we also see not just in the myths, but in the establishment of, particularly in Egypt and Greece throughout the Middle East, the the dramas that would appear in the public settings. And we had those great Greek dramas in which certain values and principles were taught. But this did not only occur in the West, it also occurred in the East in the form of musical presentations. The entire Bhagavad Gita is but a musical recitation of ancient wisdom sung before people, and they would go from village to village singing and teaching in that way. And we also have their teachings preserved for us in parable and myth in the mystery schools throughout the ancient times, where there were plays and productions for the general population, but then those who were really serious in understanding the significance of those images, those symbols, those plays, who really wanted to understand it, could enter into the deeper levels of instruction in those mystery schools. So the word mystery doesn't mean that nobody knew about it. They were common knowledge. But the word mystery means there was a veil. It was like a curtain on a stage. You had the play, but if you wanted to get behind the curtain to understand the real meaning of the play, you had to make some effort. So we talked about some of the similarities of tradition and myths that point to the idea that these were not unique beings, but were representative of a lodge of adepts, a lodge of perfected human beings. We can turn to the stories that surround the figures that we are most aware of. And there are many, many others, but we are mostly aware of the lives of Krishna, Buddha, and Jesus. And in our respective traditions, we may learn about those lives. But what we want to understand and what Theosophy points us to is that the myths, the stories, the legends that surround these individuals are remarkably the same. So they are symbolic of a process of initiation, of development and success of a soul being, and do not refer to the uniqueness of any one individual. So in all these individuals, we see that they are regarded as divinely begotten saviors, very often from a virgin mother. And they show prominent ability as youths. And as they grow up, they are persecuted and their lives are threatened. And they face all sorts of temptations. And in some point of their lives, they may even be physically harmed in their bodies. And they may, at some point in their lives, they seem to go into a trance or a period of descent into the netherworld or some other region to save the souls there, and then they are resurrected or reborn or rejuvenated and come forth and in triumphant nature and manifest in the traditions as gods, and they're given the term saviors. But the similarity of the legends is all symbolic of the soul's venture, of the soul's journey in this life, incarnating into the world of matter, becoming opposed by it, becoming deluded by it, becoming oppressed by it, and having yet to struggle in that condition in order not only to liberate and rejuvenate itself, but also lift up the intelligence in all those kingdoms. As said in the voice of the silence, a master is arisen, a master of the day, and all of nature feels with joyous awe that upward influence, that success, that triumph of that soul. So what then is the work of the lodge? Well, they're human beings, and they work as we work. They're very busy, perhaps even more busy than us. But how do we work? What do we use? Well, regardless of What we do, whether we're working with our hands, our mind, our feet, our muscles, our pencils, whatever we do, we have to use our creative power. And creative doesn't mean that we create something out of nothing. It means we have an ability to use pre-existing materials and fashion it and use it into something new that's useful. Whether it's building a street, or erecting a school, or writing a paper, we're taking pre-existing ideas or materials and fashioning it into something new. And then we have preservative abilities. Well, we certainly have to preserve and keep going what we've created. We have to maintain that school, that road, that body of knowledge, that family, if that's all we work, we feed them, we clothe them. We had to preserve their integrity and their strength and their unity. How else do we work? Well, sometimes we have to redirect and refashion and regenerate and improve upon what we've created. So we all have creative, preservative, and regenerative powers that we use when we work. And they do too. But they use them in different ways because their knowledge and their understanding and their power gives them that opportunity. And it's an opportunity that's before all of us if that's what we would choose. But it is a very unique work. It's a service for humanity. So what do they do? Well, for one thing, they receive as an inheritance the accumulated wisdom of the ages, just as when we come in these buildings. We receive as an inheritance passed down to us in writings, the wisdom of the ages. But they work to check, test, and verify it because they have the ability to look into the very heart of nature with their developed powers and to examine all sorts of things. So they work to understand life, to create a body of knowledge. When you think about it, this earth is not in the same condition, same place in the universe, in the solar system that it was thousands or millions of years ago. The conditions are different. The environment's different. So they work to understand it, and they add to and yet study and verify that accumulated body of wisdom. And part of their knowledge, their soul wisdom, is to understand that this universe is not here by miracle or by chance. It's definitely here for a purpose. It is here for the evolution of soul. It is, in fact, created, fashioned by soul beings. By ourselves, if you will, or all different degrees, collectivities of beings. And we might say the great plan or design of the universe is the collective effort of all the spiritual intelligences, all the souls involved in its manifestation. And understanding that, they understand that we as human beings, are as soul beings, we're part of that too, but we don't realize it. We don't understand the scope of our effort and our possibility. But they do, and so they work with nature. They become co-workers with nature, trying to carry out the grand possibilities of this universe. And so they are very much involved and participate in the evolution of the earth and all its various departments, as well as in the evolution of humanity as it develops. But they are also preservers. They preserve the knowledge gained. They preserve not just their own knowledge, but there has been knowledge gained that has been lost. How about all those hundreds of volumes that were destroyed in the Alexandria Library? Or all those volumes and things lost in the East when there were invasions by barbaric tribes? Or how about all those monuments that contained all those that knowledge that were destroyed through the years? there's been tremendous knowledge accumulated by humanity that would be otherwise lost if it was not preserved by those who've watched over the progress, the decline, and rise again of civilizations age after age. So they are the bearers of the truth, the accumulated wisdom of humanity, the progress we made, of the philosophical ideas that humanity down through the ages has found to be helpful and beneficial, regardless of the temporary blips and changes in the affairs politically or socially or religiously or economically. There are certain ideas, certain achievements. How about agriculture? You know, human beings are the only beings that clothe themselves. They're the only beings that know how to make a fire. They're the only beings that communicate their self-reflective ideas. There's so many things that we've done as human beings that we've done through the ages that has been constant, has been preserved. There are certain innate, inherent ideas that we carry forth. And finally, as said, they are the not just the creators and preservers, but they are the regenerators. And so they constantly watch over the progress of their younger brother souls. And whenever they see an opportunity, whether with an individual or a group, to give a little inspiration or an idea that will awaken that soul further, that will guide them further, they look for that opportunity. But they just don't do that privately behind the scenes. As we said, sometimes they come out publicly and through great philosophers and teachers and reformers among them, they share their knowledge according to the times and the temperament of the people that they've accumulated. And they are therefore, we use the term, the great founders of the theosophical movement that was referred to in the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. So this is such an amazing topic to think of. The idea that a human being can become godlike in its power because we are all in fact from one divine source. It forces us, it challenges us to ask ourselves, well, what's getting in the way? Why can't I be like them? Why don't I even want to be them, like them? What's holding me back? What do I believe about myself that gets in the way of me wanting to aspire to be like them? And it is said that wherever there are individuals that hold that ideal and that fact of human perfectibility high in their hearts and minds, wherever there is that effort, they make an effort to help and be of service. So we invite you to reflect, if you will, or share your ideas and comments and questions with the rest of us. Yes?
So are all these masters from our own humanity, civilizations, or can they be from any other world chains?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are adepts who have become adepts on this particular earth. So if we say, as Theosophy teaches, that thinking humanity, soul beings have been incarnating in human forms on this earth for 18 million years, then there must have been at that time a nursery of adepts established whereby from those earliest times a certain path of development could be available for those individuals who wanted to pursue that. And so there have been adepts. But when you think about it, in order for that nursery to be established, there had to be the master teachers, the professors who came along and set it up and began the teaching and taught humanity the arts and sciences and instilled the innate ideas and taught us how, you know, to clothe ourselves, these things that spring up spontaneously. in no other kingdom. And so they are soul beings that acquired their knowledge in previous periods of evolution. Just as those that become adepts on this particular earth, in the next great period of evolution, where there is a new planetary scene for the souls from this planet to evolve on, those who have become adepts now will be the teachers of that future generation. So each new cycle, there is a never-ending process of development and perfection. Each new cycle sees more and more numbers of those adepts. And here's the great prospect put before us. Before the end of evolution on this earth, humanity, or at least those individual souls who have struggled life after life to reach that degree of development, humanity at that time will be a race of adepts. Yes, in the very back.
It was said during the talk that we found it interesting that the lodge of adepts is no particular place, but it's a collectivity of all the adepts of all the thinkers of that level. And we just find that interesting because the lodge, the word lodge, its etymology is logos. And so we kind of see a correspondence between what's going on within the lodge and the higher.
Yes. So in the Eastern derivation of that word, it would refer to the Great Lodge would be a great school. A great school. And so, well, we can attend universities now on the internet. So we know that a school does not have to be at a certain place. It's wherever there's a link, a connection between one mind who knows more with another mind, who knows the same or knows less or knows more. So wherever that a link is established, there can be a school, a lodge, an influence. Yes?
It's obviously very commendable that this brotherhood of adepts are ensuring that this humanity doesn't destroy itself and its improper behaviors over the millions of years. Why are they so timid and not actively coming out and teaching this humanity how to not to destroy ourselves, whereas simply ensuring that we don't, while our behaviors are obviously completely radically different? Why not come out and actively teach versus furtively teach?
Well, it's a good question, and actually it's going to be taken up next week, the invisible guardian wall. So why is it an invisible guardian wall and not, as you say, an actual physical wall? Well, it's not to say that they can't come out physically. But we would have to ask ourselves, and of course they ask us to consider, what do you think would be the response of average humanity in its current condition? What would you think would be response if they came out? Well, just look at history. How has history shown that a people or a nation has treated those wise beings who've come out as reformers? You know, in being creatives, preservers, regenerators, they also have to destroy the very institutions or speak out against the very institutions that get in the way of our progress. So how are they going to be treated? And if we're so destructive to begin with, why would they want to tempt us? So they are here to help us. And so their work is not so much done directly, but through their agents. So it is said, Mr. Judge says, it is the work of the Lodge of Adepts to preserve the ancient wisdom. It is work of their companions, agents of all different degrees, to rediscover and promulgate it, to make it present in the world. And some of those agents are conscious, and some of them are unconscious, meaning they are individuals who do not necessarily know about the lodge but are so pure and high-minded and dedicated in themselves that they attract their influence and they are inspired by them. They may give credit to some other source, but they feel a presence and influence, a direction in their lives that they, and a wisdom coming through them that they cannot explain. In the back.
We love the reading from the opening reading, and we never noticed before a particular word. Most of the wording is the thrilling and the joy of nature when this adept arises, but it also says nature is subdued. Why would nature be subdued if it was in the midst of this joyous expression at whatever level?
Mm. What would you say is the nature of the, what would you say is the quality of the intelligence in nature, in lower nature around us? Yes.
Well, it's there. It's all different according to the kingdom.
It's different. Is it guided by law?
Yes.
Always?
Yes.
Okay. Is it guided by the intelligence in those kingdoms?
Yes.
Okay. Where does that intelligence come from? Where does the influence from that intelligence come from? We call it instinct, okay, in the animal kingdom. Sensitivity in the plant kingdom. Now, if there is intelligence evolving in all the kingdoms that is impressionable and can give out impressions, what effect do you think humanity has on that intelligence in nature as it presently is? Destructive? Are we chaotic in our thinking? Are we steady? Are we always directive? So we influence nature. We stir it up. And we only have to look at the weather and climate of nature around us to understand that. We can put hundreds of species into extinction in such a short period of time through our carelessness. It's amazing. So how would nature respond to the presence of a very wise, powerful, and beneficent influence? Would it not, like the puppy who's petted gently, relax, be subdued, be calmed, get back to its normal instinctive tendencies? Well, that's the idea. That when they come forth as servants, as friends of humanity, it's not just for humanity's sake, but it's for all of life's sake. Not just for this kingdom, but for the kingdoms of intelligence developing below us. Their influence is felt by all the lower kingdoms. And they thrill in that sense because they get that upward influence, but they also are subdued in the sense that all the chaos around them, they're protected from or they're subdued. So in that way, it works. Yes?
It states in the philosophy that through ideas, we manifest speech, and from speech, we manifest action. And we're, I think we're also told that a lot of things are explained to us in analogy and correspondence, because words can't be spoken, understood at another one. But isn't that also true for events in life, like horrific events that we see in our society? They keep on going over them and going over them, and they're constantly in the atmosphere of, you know, this chaos, this brutality. How, as a theosophist, can we best approach this, this idea of what we say does manifest itself, and the fact that all the things that we have done have created such suffering.
Well, your question relates to a subject that is not directly related, but we'll try to bring it in the context of our meeting this morning, in the sense of speaking of certain sacred things. We know as human beings there are certain things that can happen to us that are so shameful that there's no way we could feel we could express it, not even to our families. And yet we also know there are certain ideas, convictions we hold that are so important to us that we are afraid to express it because it might be critical, ridiculed, or addressed. And sometimes there are things some ideas and truths we grasp, we understand, we know, but they're so high that we don't know the words to write them down. We just know we know, but we can't express it. And then maybe we come across a book or we come across theosophy and we find in a language that which resonates with the ideas we already hold. But we acknowledge that there are certain things that are sacred, that are so deep to us, that they cannot be really expressed or understood. And in that same way, the Lodge of Adepts, what they go through, their lives, their trials, their joys, their sufferings, because they are human beings, are so far beyond the scope of our understanding that it cannot be said in so many words because it would be understood. But it can be symbolized. And that is the purpose of the great symbolism we see throughout ages in the myths and the traditions of the trials and sufferings that the various saviors go through, because it represents, it's symbolic of stages in a play or acts in a play that the pilgrim soul goes through. It's a way of expressing in symbolic form. So in a way, what you're saying, words are very powerful things. And some words we know just can't be spoken because either we don't have the power to express them, or we know if we do express them, they could be possibly abused or misused or used against us by certain people. So we become very careful of the way we use language. And so the same idea. A lot of the mystery around the adepts, a lot of so-called secrecy, is not because they don't want to share it. It's just that it can only come out publicly. They can only talk about it or express themselves publicly in certain cycles of humanity when humanity temperamentally is ready to understand it and can use it to its highest degree. And so they can work publicly and privately, all the at different cycles, but they are always working for humanity, regardless of the cycle. Yes.
For that same line of thinking regarding the speech, wouldn't it be simpler if we just looked at where we could direct that influence through our own awareness? It's been said that we're here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness. Mm-hmm. So we have to get past and understand why we are separate from ourselves, even in our own thinking, first before we can actually share something from that place with another. And we do it with the ones closest to us. If we look at our everyday activities, we actually don't do and meet too many people during the course of the day. You know, we go to work, we see who we see, there's all these people walking around. And then you have these things inside of this, questions you may have or things you may want to share. But I think if we just maybe start with the things which are closest to us, become aware of ourselves, get to understand ourselves better, then we can have the freedom and not be fearful of trusting another person and not paying so much attention to all that stuff that was more or less programmed to all of us. You know, it's like it's been said, I just was reading it recently, it's kind of humorous, it says, we are born into hell. It scares people. Meaning, okay, we're born into a hell because there's all this craziness and chaotic nonsense for all the time. And we're here to awaken from that. It's there, but we don't have to get influenced by that much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that your question and comment then relates to the previous one of how can, recognizing the care we have to use with speech on one hand, it is a very powerful tool.
Yes.
It has creative, preservative, destructive, regenerative ability, and well, we can use it to affect the lives of those we love, our families, other individuals, nations, races. It's a very powerful tool. So how do we use it? And in a sense, it is a very important gift. The gift of speech is also something, symbolic speech, at least is, the way it's developed, is also something that's unique to humanity. And yet, regardless of our the differences of our human condition, we all express language in one way or another. And so we find these ideas, these same ideas, these teachings of these great beings expressed in different words, in different idioms and different complexities down through the ages, depending on the ears, the temperament of the audience. And so our challenge is, as students of the ancient wisdom, is okay, we can look the way Confucius said it, and we can look the way Buddha said it, and Jesus said it, and HBB said it, but how do we say it so we can help our coworker?
Practice.
Yeah. How do we say it so we can help our child who's come home from school and just been bullied? You know, how do we take this wisdom of the ages and put it into speech that does not surpass the understanding of those we are dealing with? And that's the really great creative power of speech, to take these theosophical ideas, these spiritual truths, and express them in a pure and simple way. And first we need to study them, and then you have to apply them. Because in the application of these ideas, they become living truths, living ideas, living fires. And once they are lit, you find your own words. You find your own way of saying it. You're no longer repeating like a parrot what you heard somebody else say, but you're guided by your own experience and wisdom. Now, that's the challenge for all of us individually. And that's why we're here, to try to express in different way the words that will hopefully help each one of us and all of us to advance together. Yes.
Well, we can remember very young a group of people that sort of took us aside, and they taught us certain things. But one thing they taught at that time was very young is a song. You know, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine, and it always stuck with us all through life. And they were religiously oriented, but they gave me such a gift, and it took us years to understand how to put that in right perspective, because you know, you feel that light, or you think you recognize that light, but do we need other people to point out to us?
Yes. Well, that little light in ourselves is the same as the roaring furnace that is the light of the Mahatma. The blazing sun that is the Mahatma. The only difference is what effort are we making to fan, to add to the strength, to use, to develop, to expand that light. And the only way we can is by feeding it with the right thoughts, with the word, right deeds, with the right ideas, and using it. And it will grow steadily. And we will find ourselves coming into this life, not in darkness. We may live in a dark situation around us culturally or in a civilization, but within ourselves we brought forth a light of understanding and love and power that transcends it. And that grows through the ages. So that same idea. So next week, as we said, we are continuing with this idea, humanity has never been without a friend, by looking at that idea of the invisible guardian wall. And if you want to make sure you're here, make sure you turn your clocks ahead. 1 hour, so you don't get here at the end of that wonderful talk. Okay, our meeting is adjourned.
Let me just take the